Paul, for the purpose of having for, of looking back at what the people of Israel went through in the first five books and learning from them as Christians. Here's what Paul says. I don't want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. Now, these things happened as examples for us, so that we would not crave evil things as they also crave. Do not be idolaters, if some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play. Nor let us act immorally as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Nor let us try the Lord as some of them did, and were destroyed by the serpents, nor grumble as some of them did, and were destroyed by the destroyer. I'm going to keep reading a little further. I had 11 down. Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. When we look at these verses, we see Paul saying that the books that Moses wrote about the Israelites and their journey and all that went on were written for a purpose, and that purpose was instruction for the people who follow Christ, that Paul is calling to follow Christ. And so he's saying, learn from their examples. Don't reject God. Don't pursue immorality. Don't be idolaters. Some of the things that are mentioned here, like the serpents, have yet to happen in our following of the Israelites on their journey, but we will get there. But there are lessons to learn. And the lesson that seems to be most prevalent is have faith, trust God, don't complain. Every time the situation is not working out the way you expected or the way you want, don't turn around and cry and woe is me, and I was better off before. That's a key point in there. These Israelites were not better off in Egypt. They did not have God Himself showing His presence to them as He led them to the Promised Land, a pillar of cloud by day and a fire by night. They did not have God ordering them in their society and into a nation to be His people, to have a promise received. And yet they look back and they think that time was better. Why? We had some great meals back there. And they just gave it to us. First of all, you have to say they are self-deceived. And one of the key things that is encouraging that deception is the lies they tell themselves and the way that they see everything through the lens of despair and that everything is terrible. I want to take you to another passage. Philippians 4:8. There was a time when about every few days I would be in a conversation with somebody, and these verses would be the answer to the issue we were talking about. These are, I have watched it happen to people and to myself. These are life-changing words. And Paul is talking to the church at Philippi. He's encouraging them to be full of joy. and he's encouraging them to see things accurately. And a piece of that, a big piece of that, is in verse 8. But we ought to back up a little bit. Let's start with verse 4 and go down through verse 8. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say, rejoice. Let your gentle spirit be known to all men. The Lord is near. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all comprehension, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there is anything of excellence, and if anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. There has not been a time in history when the fallenness of mankind and of creation has not affected the lives of the people. Never. Adam and Eve had the Garden of Eden, but they sure didn't have it long. And from that day forward, we have lived with what it means to be a people who are part of a fallen race living in a fallen land, but also have had extended to us reconciliation with the Creator of that world, the one in whose image we are made. We have lived in a time, and I don't care who you are, and I don't care what time you talk about, where God is accessible, where God himself can redeem your soul if, through faith, you trust him. And even that faith is a gift of God. Pray to him and ask for it. And living out of faith, as the scriptures tell us, the righteous will live by faith, do we expect instantly then everything in the world is going to be just the way we want it? No, we're in a small minority. Jesus himself said that those that are living by faith, those that are trusting in God for their righteousness, for their salvation, will be a small group on a narrow path that is difficult to find. The broad path that's wide and open and easy that most people are going to go down is still going to be there. So when we stop and look at things, is there always going to be cruelty, man's inhumanity to man? Men who have been entrusted to provide leadership for the government and in other places, that you ought to be expecting them to work on behalf of the people, but they work on behalf of themselves at the expense of the people. That's how it is. And we shouldn't expect all of those things to change this side of the new heaven and the new earth. But in the midst of that, these people are living that out. They lived under Egyptians. Were Egyptians looking out for them? No, their intent was to work them to death so they wouldn't be so powerful. And there were enemies along the way, and there will be more enemies before they get to the promised land, and there will be enemies in the promised land. What they need to see is the things that they're overlooking in Philippians 4, verse 8. What is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, if there's any excellence, if anything worthy of praise, dwell on these things. And that could start their list today with, and you have manna. God's been giving you manna every day. He's been seeing to your needs from the moment that you left Egypt, having plundered it at his direction and by the power of his might, through the plagues, and in particular the Passover, to set you on your way so that he might fulfill a promise that he made to Abraham and is now extending to them to put them in the promised land. And they're not looking at that. And that's a lesson we need to learn as we see what they're going through. What kind of times have people come through in our recent history. We can look at the brighter moments, I suppose, for those of us, I'm not old enough to remember World War II, but I was old enough to be greatly influenced by it. We could say that was a great day when World War II put down two nations that were mistreating people in horrendous ways. And both Japan and Germany were definitely guilty of that. Horrendous stuff that was brought to an end. And so now the world's right and perfect, isn't it? No. No, we live under a nuclear cloud. We lived under a time when nations were striving for power in the world. We lived under a time when people were self-deceived, where your mind could be expanded with drugs. I mean, all kinds of stuff. In all of those times, we cannot miss our opportunity to look at those things that are pure, lovely, good repute, excellent, worthy of praise, and dwell on them. God did not lose control of this world ever. And when you look ahead at the ways, the things he's going to do to bring this fallen world to an end and bring in the new heaven and the new earth and an eternity for all of his people in his presence, it's going to be kind of rough then too. And so what are our expectations? Do we strive for the things to become more excellent? Is it right for us to strive to make a better government? To hold people accountable? Yeah, absolutely. We ought to be working for good things. We were saved for good works. At the top of the list, of course, is our testimony for Christ. And yet these people can see only one thing. I miss the menu in Egypt. Well, let's move on. Moses doesn't quite get it yet either. Going back to Numbers chapter 11, in verse 21, Moses says, the people that are walking, these are the soldiers. I don't know if the rest are on carts or whatever, but we got 600,000 people on foot, yet you say we're going to provide meat for them for a whole month. What is Moses' point here? What is he saying? Put this into something a little more specific, if you can.
I can't feed that many people.
Yes, and what's wrong with that sentence? I'm not saying wrong with what you said, but wrong with Moses saying, how am I supposed to do this? I mean, he even elaborates on it. Are we going to kill all the flocks so we can feed everybody? What if we had, and hear this one, all the fish in the sea? Now, is he exaggerating? Yeah, we don't need all the fish in the sea to feed them. But what's wrong with his sentence? What's wrong with the point he's making here? The question he's asking God.
It's how I can do it, not how you do it.
He's doing I. He is approaching this like God is going to turn to him and give him a task that will involve providing this meat. And so he spends verse 22 talking about everything that would be needed, but then in verse 23 the Lord says to Moses, great question, is the Lord's power limited? Are there boundaries on what I can do, Moses? Now, he says, and I like those nows in there. I kind of have to think about them a minute, and I'm not quite sure how to translate that or take that thought and put it best in our vernacular, but pay attention. Wake up. You'll see if my words come true. What's God's point? You're not doing it, Moses. Get over it. I'm going to take care of this. What did I tell you to do is almost what God could say. And what did God tell him to do? What was his action item? He had two, really, but there's one in particular I'm thinking of right here. God gave him two actions to do. What's that?
Leave the people.
Tell the people. You're going to eat meat. That was the end of what you had to do, Moses, is just advise them of what's coming. Tell them to consecrate themselves so they'll be ready. And, of course, the other one is to gather 70 people around, because I'm going to put my spirit on them so that we will spread that load out that you've been complaining about. So Moses told the people, and he gathered the 70 men. He got it. And he placed them around the tent. And so Lord is taking care of that issue first, not the meat. And he comes down in verse 25 as a cloud, and he spoke to Moses, and then he placed the spirit that had been on Moses also on these 70 men. And they prophesied only once. It didn't happen again. And so now the spirit is on an additional 70 elders, leaders that can help and be a part of that. Now, two of the guys that were supposed to be up at the tent weren't there. What were their names?
Eldad and Medad.
Eldad and Medad. I put an M on the first one. I don't know if that's exactly the right way of pronouncing their names, but, and where were they? They were down in the camp. You almost have to wonder, should they got in trouble for that? Did they not do what they were told? What happened here? Well, we're not told, but for whatever reason, they're down in the camp. But they had been assigned as these part of this 70 men. What do they begin doing?
Prophesying.
What does that mean, prophesying here? Well, frankly, it's probably worshiping God verbally. Maybe calling the people to worship. Might be providing some information about the greatness of God and what he's doing and what he will do. I don't know. But clearly it's the spirit that has welled up in them, and they are speaking to the people out of that spirit. And so all 70 of these men are prophesying, including the two down in the camp. Now, a young man runs up and tells Moses that, hey, there's two guys down in the camp prophesying. And clearly, this young man thought it was an issue of some sort. He ran up. There's urgency in his actions. How does Joshua respond? Moses, tell him to shut up. How does Moses respond to Joshua in this case?
Are you jealous?
Well, and are you jealous for me? You know what? You're trying to preserve my special place? Is that what you're about here, Joshua? And he goes on to say, I wish everybody in the camp was filled with the Spirit, were prophets, and had the Lord's Spirit on them. If they were, life would be different, wouldn't it? Because they are sure showing their humanity that isn't being led by the Spirit very well. So, Moses basically says, this is great. The more the better. If God wants to work in this way, I'm for it. I wish he was working even more in this way. And then that takes us down to verses 31 through the end of the chapter, 31 through 35. So let me read that. Now there went forth a wind from the Lord, and it brought them quail from the sea, and let them fall beside the camp about a day's journey on this side and a day's journey on the other side, all around the camp, and about 2 cubits deep on the surface of the ground. The people spent all day and all night and all the next day and gathered the quail. He who gathered least gathered 10 homers. And they spread them out for themselves all around the camp. While the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people. And the Lord struck the people with a very severe plague. So the name of that place was called Kibroth Hattaavah, because there they buried the people who had been greedy. From Kibroth Hattaavah, Hattavah, the people set out for Hazeroth, and they remained at Hazeroth. So, is quail pretty good eating? Well, some people sure like it. I don't know if I've ever had quail. But I know one day there was a covey of quail living in one of my dad's buildings, and I took an air rifle. I was college aged. The quail, birds in the building have been a problem. They are tearing up insulation and stuff. So I see these birds, and so I pop one of them with that air rifle. There's a covey of probably 8 or 9 that had flown out. And I got one, and Dad wasn't happy, and I'm like, what in the world? We got this air rifle out here because we were having problems with birds, but it was a covey of quail. And he and a buddy were kind of watching this covey of quail, and when the bird season got right, I don't know if it was out of season or whatever, they both wanted these quail. The other guy did in particular. He was a neighbor that really liked his hunted birds. So I know somebody at least liked quail. Well, I don't think any quail hunter has ever seen anything like this. The wind came up, and from the sea, it blew in all these quail. A day's journey in any direction, and they were 2 cubits deep. That's 3 foot. 3 foot deep. A day's journey in any direction, so it's more than a mile, right? How far can you walk in a day? Well, they probably could walk a lot further than us because they were used to it, but that's a lot of quail. And so they spent all that day and all night and all the next day gathering quail. The ones who gathered the least gathered 10 homers. That is 60 to 70 bushel. Even with the feathers on, that's a lot of quail. And they spread their quail out all around the camp. They are having a great day. But verse 33 ruins it for them. The meat was still between their teeth, not yet chewed, and God became angry and brought a severe plague. And the result of what happened there is a name change to Kibroth, or name established, I don't know if it was a change. The name was Kibroth Hattaavah. And there they buried the greedy. Aren't you glad you weren't one of the greedy ones that got this started? That Kibroth Hattaavah name means graves of lust, graves of desire, graves of greediness. And so they were buried there. And quail probably lost its allure very quickly, didn't it? From there, they went to Hazeroth and they stayed there. Questions? Comments? Numbers here does not put a quantity of people that died, but it does describe them. God took out the greedy ones. What do we learn? What God doesn't provide that you are greedy for might just offend God before you're done. And in the way he was dealing with these people, he was teaching very dramatically with actual physical, real-time consequences. God may hesitate in the real-time consequences for us from time to time, but have no fear, consequences for our sin comes. Well, let's take a look at Numbers chapter 12. I'm going to read the first 16 verses. Then, right after what just happened, that's the way the then would fit in here, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman who he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. And they said, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well?" And the Lord heard it. Now the man Moses was very humble, more than any man who was on the face of the earth. Suddenly the Lord said to Moses and to Aaron and to Miriam, "You three come out to the tent of meeting." So the three came out. Then the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud and stood at the doorway of the tent and called Aaron and Miriam. When they had come forward, he said, "Hear now my words. Is there a prophet among you? I, the Lord, shall make myself known to him in a vision. I shall speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my household. With him I speak mouth to mouth, even openly, not in dark sayings, and he beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses?" So the anger of the Lord burned against them, and he departed. But when the cloud had withdrawn from over the tent, behold, Miriam was leprous, as white as snow. As Aaron turned toward Miriam, behold, she was leprous. Then Aaron said to Moses, "O my Lord, I beg you, do not account this sin to us, which we have acted foolishly and which we have sinned. Oh, do not let her be like one dead, whose flesh is half eaten away when he comes from his mother's womb." Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "Oh God, heal her, I pray." But the Lord said to Moses, "If her father had but spit in her face, would she not bear her shame for 7 days? Let her be shut up for 7 days outside the camp, and afterward she may be received again." So Miriam was shut up outside the camp for 7 days, and the people did not move on until Miriam was received again. Afterward, however, the people moved out from Hazeroth and camped in the wilderness of Paran. We get the benefit of reading this sequentially. And it is astounding, after what they just witnessed, after they had just buried enough people that they called the place the Graves of Lust, that Miriam and Aaron speak against Moses. What does it mean to speak against Moses, by the way? Well, what they said was, is it just Moses that leads the people? We too have been leading the people. Found there in verse 2, "Has indeed the Lord spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well?" Well, what was their stated reason for criticizing Moses? He did not marry a Jewish woman. He had married a Cushite, which the land of Cush was modern-day Ethiopia, south of Egypt. The way this is worded makes it sound like this is a recent event. His wife of years isn't mentioned here. Why did her name just leave my head? What's her name?
Sephora.
Sephora isn't mentioned here. And so was this Sephora? Many will say, and I tend to think it's right, the way that is worded is it makes it sound like this was a recent event. Had Sephora died? What happened? We're not really given any information. And maybe this is Sephora, but from years ago, but she was a Midianite, so that wouldn't fit. So this is another woman that has come into the picture. Go over to Genesis chapter 10. Look, we're going to look at verses 6 and 7. Genesis 10, verses 6 and 7. Because this might even add just a little bit more to their concern about a woman that's a descendant of Cush. Genesis 10, 6 and 7. "The sons of Ham were Cush and Mizraim and Put and Canaan. The sons of Cush were Seba and Havilah and Sabta and Rama and Sabtica. And the sons of Ram were Sheba and Dedan. So they came out of this lineage. Cush was one of the sons of Ham. What's Ham known for? Disgracing Noah. Yeah, he's the one that saw his father unclothed and made a joke out of it and a few other things. And so Noah set a curse on Ham indirectly. His curse was actually pronounced against Canaan. But Cush was a brother of Canaan. And so here is Moses having taken a wife that was from the lineage of Ham, which was the disobedient, I want to say that differently, but a disobedience fits, but he was the son who dishonored Noah and then received the curse put on Canaan as a result. And so Miriam and Aaron bring that up. That's what they're saying against Moses, but they also are saying, God talked through us too. And did God use Miriam and Aaron? In particular, let's say Aaron for a moment. Sure he did. But Aaron's actions were given as directions through Moses. Aaron was there to help with Moses when he needed somebody to help speak for him. And Aaron was involved with miraculous things throughout the time of the plagues and other things. He didn't do very well for himself over around the Mount Sinai. Kind of embarrassed himself there with the golden calf story. But here they are complaining, going, hey, God talks through us too, not just Moses. What emotion are they acting out of? Pretty obviously. Yeah, they're jealous. Why is he being the big cheese? We're cheese too. And that's what they wanted to get across. They're jealous. There is a recent event that might have fueled their jealousy just a little bit, because Moses not only dealt with the food and God brought in the quail, but they also brought in 70 elders, right? And the Spirit went on them and they prophesied. Doesn't say Aaron was one of those 70 elders. And so maybe that was a little bit of a spark or a trigger for their jealousy. And so the Lord heard it in verse 3. I can't help it. What comes to my mind is the teacher outside the classroom door when the kids are misbehaving. And all of a sudden they realize, uh-oh, teacher heard all that. The Lord heard it. And we get this statement that Moses was a very humble man, most humble on the earth. Some commentators would like to say, well, here's proof that Moses didn't write this. If he was truly humble, he couldn't have said this about himself. That's bunk. You write down, if you are writing down on behalf of the Spirit of God, scriptures, you write down what the Spirit tells you. So this is what Moses wrote. What does it mean to be humble? If we look here, the Hebrew is anav. I'm not sure I said that right. A-N-A-V is how we would transliterate that into English. Talks about, uses words like meek, humble, poor, lowly, even afflicted sometimes. But almost always it's humble is how it's translated to English. What does it mean to be humble?
Not voiced about yourself?
Not what?
Not voiced about yourself?
Well, yeah. I mean, a humble person is not going to be a braggart, are they?
Right.
Okay. What else would it mean? Just a little more than that, because you can never say a word about yourself and still not be humble.
I don't realize they deserve the honor and praise for those accomplishments.
Okay. All right. I think we struggle with the word humble a little bit, because a humble person is a person who will correctly assess themselves, including the negative things, but also including some positive things. If you're able to go out on the golf course and drive the golf ball straight down the fairway every time further than anybody else you know, you're not lacking in humility if you just simply say, "I." That's what happens every time I hit the ball. That's not a lack of humility. That's just accurate self-assessment. Now, if you start hiring a company to promote you and build you up an image as the best golf player in the world, now we got a problem. But Moses has been blessed by God, and he has become an intermediary with God, but he is humble. This isn't about Moses, it's about God. And that's what makes him humble. Moses doesn't serve Moses. Moses doesn't promote Moses. Moses promotes doing what God said, honoring God, and living things out in a way that pleases God. And it's God himself, through Moses' pen, that says Moses is extremely humble. And it fits into this passage how? Well, to answer that question, just ask a different question. Aaron and Miriam, are they headed down the path of humility here? We're as good as he is, or whatever. And so in verse 4, we see suddenly. That's a key word. This is abruptly. This is in a surprising way. The Lord calls out Moses, Aaron, and Miriam to come out of the tent. And they came out. How do you suppose Miriam and Aaron are feeling right now? He didn't drag us out for a good reason, did he? They knew that. They knew it was jealousy in their heart. Don't we always know when our motives are out of line? And so when he came down then in a pillar of cloud, he stood in the doorway of the tent and he called to Aaron and Miriam. And when they came forward, he said, "Hear my words." Pay attention, in other words. "If there is a prophet, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I will speak to him in a dream." God says, this is the way I deal with prophets. But this isn't how I deal with Moses. He just set Moses above the prophets when he said, not with Moses. He's faithful in all my household. Moses at this time is more of the household of God than he is the household of mankind. And that word household, I tried to get some help from looking up what the Hebrew word was, but basically 54 times it's translated household, 3 times family. This, he is one of the group that God is leading as his personal family. The New Living Translation says it this way: he's the one I trust. That would be good words to be said. God clearly set him apart as reliable. And he says, in contrast to the visions and the dreams, with him I speak mouth to mouth, even openly. Not in sayings hid in darkness. In other words, hard to understand. You can't see much in the darkness, right? Things become vague and so on. But no, he hears it clearly. And he beholds the form of God. I think our best way to understand that is to go over to Exodus chapter 33. And we're going to read verses 7 through 11. Now this is a time, Exodus 33, this is a time when things aren't going real well with the people. Moses has been up on the mountain, came down, Here's the golden calf, and there is an explanation given to us about how Moses was used to interacting with God, and that explanation is given to us before that we get the plea by Moses when God says, I'm going to send an angel to lead you, and Moses says, you, please, return, do it. This is what Moses was used to, 33:7-11. Moses used to take the tent and pitch it outside the camp, a good distance from the camp, and he called it the tent of meeting. And everyone who sought the Lord would go out with it out to the tent of meeting, which was outside the camp. And it came about whenever Moses went out to the tent that all the people would arise and stand, each at the entrance of his tent, and gaze after Moses until he entered the tent. Whenever Moses entered the tent, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent, and the Lord would speak with Moses. And when all the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, all the people would rise and worship, each at the entrance of his tent. Thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, just as a man speaks to his friend. When Moses returned to the camp, his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, would not depart from the tent. Moses was used to a very unique and special communication out of the relationship that he had with God. And God is using that as an illustration to say, don't you understand how close Moses and I are? And so in verse 8, it goes on to say, why were you not afraid to speak against my servant, against Moses? God said, Moses and I are intertwined in this enough, you should have been afraid to even think about talking bad about Moses, because when you talk bad about Moses, you're talking bad about me. I am leading Moses. It's personal, it's direct. Get over it quick. You're offending me. And so God had reason to expect them to have observed Moses in that status. Why? Look at all the intercessions that God made. Just a few. Golden calf intercession. Moses went up. Aaron didn't go up and talk to God about how to deal with this and how to ask God for grace and forgiveness and to continue with the people. Who went to the top of the mountain? Aaron? Miriam? No, Moses. He would come out of his meetings with God with a glowing face to the point he had to wear a veil to not scare the people. And they're there going, who does Moses think he is? God says, let me tell you who Moses is. And in verse 9, it says that God's anger burned against them, Miriam and Aaron, and he departed. Scary moment for Miriam and Aaron, and it gets worse. When the cloud left, Miriam was left with leprosy. She was leprous. She was white as snow, advanced in the leprosy. Oh, what thoughts they must have had, Aaron and Miriam. We had a fire at the edge of the camp. We had the quail and the death that followed. And now they've got God mad enough at them. Things are happening to them. And so Aaron is upset. And Aaron then turns to Moses. And what he says is, oh my Lord, he's talking to Moses, not to God. I beg you, do not account this sin to us. I think he got it. When you're talking to Moses, you're talking to God's right-hand man, has sway with God. Moses was the one they directly offended, but Moses wasn't even taking offense. It was God who was really offended. So don't count this sin to us, and we've acted foolishly, and we have sinned. Oh, don't let her be like one of the dead whose flesh is half eaten away when he comes from his mother's womb. The leprosy was a bane that was just horrendous, and it would cause the flesh to deteriorate, to be eaten away mostly because of how they handled themselves. They lacked pain sensation, and how they would deal with it would often destroy their own flesh, just personally deal with it. Moses responded. He cried out to the Lord, saying, "Oh God, heal her, I pray." And this is so illustrative of the relationship between God and Moses. Lord said to Moses, he's there talking. He just left in the pillar of cloud, and now he's talking to Moses. If her father had spit in her face, she would be in shame for 7 days. She would be unclean. She'd have to be ostracized from the camp, be out of the camp. Let her be shut up for 7 days outside the camp, and then she can be received again. Did God show grace to Miriam? Wow. And Aaron. And so Miriam was shut up outside the camp for 7 days. The people did not move on until she was received again. It held up their movement for 7 days while she became clean again. Her uncleanness passed after her 7 days out of the camp. Afterward, however, the people then left from Hazeroth and they went to the wilderness of Paran. I've kept you a couple extra minutes, but these are very teachable passages. And we're not done with teachable passages. We're going to move right into another one. But thank you, and we'll see you next week.